So, Mr. and Madam President, what are you going to do in terms of viruses? What set of protections are you going to put in place? I'm going to give you the general set of possibilities. Okay, you have limited sharing, limited function, limited transmittivity, which we know is not practical, at least today. You have things like integrity shells. You have virus monitors, virus scanners, and other sundry defenses. Okay? So to go at it systematically, let's talk about limited sharing. You think that limited sharing might apply in any portion of your test?
Probably.
Probably. That's not very useful. How do you think a university president might use limited sharing to mitigate the risks associated with viruses in their environment? Limited on a departmental level, so that what, departments can't talk to each other?
Or limited.
Somehow limit the interdepartmental sharing?
Perhaps also split it so that students and the faculty are in some
group. Ah, separate faculty from students.
Exactly.
Oh, boy. I don't know, I think the politics of university life would prohibit that. Any other suggestions? Limited sharing list. Okay, how about limited function? Is there anywhere in a university environment that we can limit function? Can't come up with it. Nope. Everybody has to be able to do right programs, for example, right?
Well, depends.
Right here. Let's look. Actually, in the university environment, the highest exposure comes from business systems. Okay? The university has payroll systems like everybody else. Okay? They have student records. And so forth. So, one thing you can do, and also, there's no reason that anybody in the world needs direct access to student records or payroll information at a university. So, in fact, you can essentially isolate things like payroll systems from the internet and from the rest of the environment at the university without inhibiting the function at all. Okay? That's a way to limit sharing in a university environment that's highly effective, not only in protecting against viruses, but also protecting the privacy of the information that your users have, the privacy of your student record, the privacy of your payroll information, disciplinary information, and so forth. So all the business systems can be kept physically isolated. You can also limit the functionality in most administrative systems. Course registration. Is there a reason that people entering data for course registration need to do anything other than enter the course registration data for the students in their department, for example? There's no reason they need to be able to write programs in order to enter what courses you're taking. So all the administrative systems in the university are subject to limited function. That's an effective technique for them as well. How about something like an integrity shell or a virus monitor? Where would that apply in the university environment?
Throughout,
everywhere. Can you think of any situation other than some highfalutin research project that's a little bit bizarre where you would not want such software? Yeah, computer security research, you might want to turn it off. Okay, so you could use that potentially throughout. How about giving the academic side independent control, some limited budget, and assistance as needed? Okay, professors, here's your budget for antiviruses. You can spend it on anything you want. Have a good time. You get $10 per box. If you decide to work together, you may actually be able to buy a license to McAfee for $10 per box for the whole place, but it's up to you. They may decide on something else. They may build some fancy new amazing research firewall intended to screen all the viruses at the outside and then, of course, find out that their students are the authors of most of the viruses that they experience anyway, but that's another issue. create a disciplinary committee. All right. A financial institution. Suppose I'm running ACF2. This is one of these highly protective or reasonably protective mainframe operating systems that uses Bell and LaPadula models. And the same things we were talking about earlier for protection. And so they have ACF2 on a mainframe, and they use Novell NetWare on networks with Microsoft clients for their large portion of their user base. They have a policy against importing software. They have 2,000 programmers full-time, most of them programming the mainframe and occasionally some clients to talk to the mainframe that exists on these PCs. They feel good about their change control. They have a pretty reasonable change control system in place. It's not maybe as good as you might use for nuclear weapons, but it's probably a lot better than you use for the burger joint down the street. They have research and development separate from production, separate facilities, identical mainframes, but separate facilities. They use electronic funds transfers that it's all covered by cryptographic stuff that they trust and believe in, have used for a long time. They also have loss limiting on it. They do background checks on employees in important areas. They have bonding, they have insurance. They have audits of their electronic funds transfer system as well as their network security. So how would you rate their present status in terms of virus protection based on this list of stuff they do? Speak up. You think it's pretty good? You think background checks are effective against viruses? It might be good against insider-written viruses, but it might improve your chances, as well as the change control, right? Yeah, absolutely. Seems like reasonable steps. So, if, you know, for example, one of the employees who's working in one of this network of PCs that runs all the tellers in all your banks, for example, or where you're doing your input for stock trading. Suppose one of these folks gets a virus on a floppy disk and inserts it into the system. It comes with some other software they're inserting to do some analysis or something like that. They toss it in. Is that what's going to happen with that virus? Where's it going to go? Sorry? To the tellers. Well, it's going to go all the way through the whole PC networks, right? It could potentially spread to all the PCs. All of your data entry can be corrupted throughout the entire bank. Financial institution. It's not just a bank. They could enter wrong electronic funds transfers. That virus could spread around, find systems where people are entering financial data on upcoming initial public offerings, and leak that information out by transferring funds using a covert channel, right? It's going to make four funds transfers. One is the numerical value equivalent to the name of the company. The next one is their current actual value as calculated by some net present value computation. Next one is the date of the expected IPO, and the last digit is some internal analysis of the rating that they're giving internally to this thing that's not supposed to be leaked out. Okay, that would be illegal, right, to get that information. So now I've gotten that information on this IPO. That I could do that with a custom virus. With the generic virus that just sort of crashed a lot of systems, or that just sort of corrupted numerical data, right? How about if I just write a virus that looks for things that look like numbers and changes them? Just changes a random bit in every byte that's part of what looks like a number. What would that do to this financial institution's information? Down the tubes, man. That would be severe, right? That could be very severe. All right, so maybe they're not doing enough.
I'd be worried about 2,000 programmers.
Oh, you'd be worried. Good idea. Here, let's look at the next sheet, the cheat sheet. Here, EFT could use strong change control. They don't see that. It's not 2,000 programmers, and you claim to have good change control. How can you have good change control when you have 2,000 people writing programs for you? So of those 2,000 people, what, 1,000 are doing change control? Right, we said it takes one person in change control for, we said this earlier, it takes one person in change control for every person writing programs to do a proper job of checking their work. Hard to believe you have that many people doing change control. Hard to believe that you can make as many changes as 2,000 programmers make in a day and really understand what you're doing. How about Novell? This thing is a big risk in that whole Novell network. You probably want to put some kind of integrity checks to make sure that these viruses aren't spreading rampantly or corrupting the network or corrupting all the PCs. All things that you came up with. Good. Computer company scenario. Corporate security chief in a major company. Say you have 500,000 installed computers. You have yearly upgrades of some things. Probably the computers last 2 years. So every 2 years you're replacing a large portion of the 500,000 installed computers. You have 10,000 programmers. You have one detected internal security violation per week.
Something's wrong.
10,000 programmers, one violation per week. That's 50 violations per year. One detected. Out of 10,000 people writing programs.
That's not good.
That's not good?
That means something's kind of slipping through. Something's slipping through.
Huh?
Something's slipping through.
Something's slipping through.
Brilliant.
Something's slipping through. Yes. Yes, obviously something is slipping through somewhere. What are you going to do about the virus thing? Remember, we're talking about viruses. These aren't one detected virus per week. Just a security violation.
Well, if that's not so strong, you got to wonder what the virus protection is.
There is no virus protection.
Yeah.
Do you see any virus protection here?
No.
No virus protection. Just a big network of computers, lots of people doing programming. Lots of network connectivity, because that's how you do programming. So what are you going to do in this organization? What's the list? What's the first thing you can do?
Limit sharing.
Can you limit sharing in this environment? You think not? Limit function. Can you limit function?
Probably not.
Probably not. It's hard to have programming without being able to write programs. How about strong change control? Can you use strong change control?
Require a massive change control problem.
Five times worse than the other one.
This is five times worse than the last one. No, you're not a hope. All right, well, maybe. How about integrity checking? You check integrity throughout this whole network? Virus scanning. Can you do virus scanning? Don't answer the question. I know you can put in virus scanning. Let me flip to the next page and see. So generally what we need to do here is we start out with what are the exposures. Okay? You're in a big company. You're writing programs. You have 10,000 people writing programs, and you're selling these programs or giving the services provided by these programs or selling the services, one way or the other. What's the exposure here? Where do you stand to lose big money?
Productivity of the programmers.
Sorry?
And the productivity of the programmers.
The productivity of the programmers can be harmed. If you got a virus and it took down your network, you'd be paying a heck of a lot of money for people to sit there and not do anything. Yeah, but sort of you're paying that money anyway, right? As long as it doesn't affect sales, what do you care? Just a thought. I mean, you're right. It affects programmer productivity. It might be very severe, very expensive. Is that the biggest exposure? What else is a big exposure? What do you deliver? And who do you deliver it to?
What product of the company is.
We're selling software and services.
And you can passing registered viruses on your clients.
Sorry, you might be able to, oh, passing viruses on your clients. Oh my goodness, yes.
They're not gonna like it.
If you're delivering software to the clients, if you're Microsoft, and you're delivering software, and you get viruses throughout your internal network all the time, and you're delivering that in the software, that's no good. May not be so bad to have the viruses yourself, but to deliver them in all your distributions would destroy your business. Okay, so we figured out that we probably want to have some sort of controls that limit the effect of any internal viruses on the products and services we deliver. Right, that makes sense, right? Can we do that by limiting sharing?
Yeah.
Yeah, tell me about it.
Separate R&D and production.
Separate R&D and production. Okay. So this is looking like moving towards sound change control. Is that right? Is that what your notion is?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the notion. But can you do sound change control for 10,000 programmers?
No, but there's something wrong.
No but. Okay. So I like the but part. The question is, what innovation do you do to do that?
Before shipping out something, you can isolate the part that you can ship out and test it through various hard tests and see what problems it has. And if it's successful, then you can send it out.
All right, so you can isolate the production version of the software and do significant testing before release. I'll go a step further. You can isolate the production software and do change control on the production software beyond what you do on the research and development side, right? That is, the people doing R&D might be writing lots of little programs that don't end up in the product. There's all sorts of programming that goes on. You might have internal databases you build to analyze how you're performing, to keep track of your software process, keep track of your customer bases. None of that affects that end user product, right? You can isolate your payroll systems, run them on some other, on a mainframe, something that has software that does payroll and doesn't allow the same viruses to operate in that environment. Right, so there are some things that you can do in that environment, of course. This is when we would normally take a break, but we're not going.
We're rolling right along.
I don't want to leave you with the misimpression that all viruses are bad, although the term virus is generally associated with negatives, right? We also, nowadays, we have these things that we call, I guess what, intelligent agents, which are really not intelligent at all, and they aren't actually agents, but that's another issue. That's the word we give to programs that, in many cases, reproduce and go out and into the field and look for things on our behalf and send back the results. Okay? We may reproduce them instead of them reproducing themselves. We may simply install them on systems and have them work on our behalf. So we make requests and they come back with answers. Okay, so if we install them, they're not viruses. If they get there on their own, they are. Or they might be if they or do that through a reproductive process. So there are a couple questions worth asking. Are all viruses bad? What are the dangerous properties? How can we avoid them? Can safe viruses be useful? And I want to go through some examples. The definition, basically, it's a program that reproduces, maybe evolves. Nothing inherently harmful in the notion. In fact, if there was something inherently bad about the notion, we would have to say that we are all bad, right? Because we are all the product of reproduction. So, let's see, the question is reproduction fundamentally bad? Much of computer use is actually data reproduction. In fact, if you look at it, something like 50% of the instructions a computer executes reproduce data. Okay, they copy data from disk into memory, they move data from somewhere in memory to somewhere else in memory, and then we multiply. And then we take the result, and we copy it out to somewhere else, and we store it somewhere else, and we pull data from two places and combine it together in a new form and print it out. It's all just copying stuff, reproducing data in large quantities. Another one is programs regularly reproduce an installation. Right, the installation process, where I put a floppy into a system or a CD into a system, or I load something from the internet. These are, many of these processes involve programs that reproduce themselves. They take themselves, they copy themselves onto another media, they expand some portion of themselves out, they reconfigure the system they loaded themselves onto for that function to perform. And in many cases, they leave an original copy of that program on the new system so that you can reproduce it somewhere else. So the process is not that different from installation. So what are the risks in reproduction? One of them is that it can reproduce something malicious. For example, you know, Windows contains Trojan horses. Right? Windows is full of Trojan horses. All the Windows distributions have, they call them Easter eggs, it's a better name, but it's a Trojan horse, right? It's a program that does something other than the documented function. In some cases, things that are harmful to your system. There are various instances where installing Windows, for example, destroyed all the README files on the system. Right? Replacing, you know, installing its own READMEs, but destroying all READMEs belonging to anything else. Assuming that it had the right to the README file name or some such thing. So, in fact, the normal installation and distribution process of software has the potential, and in fact, in reality, deposits malicious code all over the place. But that's nevertheless a problem of reproduction. Another problem is that reproduction itself can consume resources. In fact, if something is reproducing out of control, it might consume tremendous resources. That's what happened in the internet virus, the Morris program. It consumed all the resources of all these computers throughout the internet. In fact, if it hadn't consumed all the resources, they may not have noticed it for quite some time. That's primarily what most of the macro viruses do. Some might leak information, some might delete information, but mostly they consume lots of resources. How about that the progeny may not work properly? Right, this after it reproduces and goes into a new system, it might not work right. Might not work right because that system configuration isn't right, because it changed something in the system, it destroyed the environment, because it was deposited on a Macintosh and it's meant to run on a Windows box. Okay, so if it reproduces out of control, it might not work right. Of course, any program that we run might not work right. In fact, all of them, almost every program we've ever seen doesn't work right under some circumstances. Right? That's just the nature of programs in their environment. That the progeny might spoil the environment for other programs. Okay? That is, this reproduced thing might damage the environment, might consume space, might consume time, might modify something in the environment that makes some other program not run properly. These are the risks associated generally with reproduction. And there are also risks with any other program. How dangerous and how to avoid it? Uncontrolled reproduction is easy to avoid. Okay? For example, all you need to do is control the reproductive process. There are lots of ways of doing it. One way to do it is to provide a system reproduction routine. Okay? That's a so-called a viral computing environment. What we do is we make a special instruction called reproduce. Okay? And anytime a virus wants to reproduce, it calls the reproduce instruction. And it makes another copy of itself. The system does it. You say reproduce, boop, you're reproduced. So if you don't want those viruses in your system, what you do is you don't install the reproduce instruction. Like the fork command, yes, but you know, this is the viral reproduce instruction. So we could write viruses, benevolent viruses, that all use the reproduce instruction as their only means of reproducing. And then anybody that wants to run the viral computing environment loads the reproduce program. All right, for example, if it's under Unix, you have a program called reproduce. Here it is. If any program says, you know, reproduce in its own name, and reproduce creates another copy of it, and runs it. It does copy the name you provided me to new name. That with, you know, suppose you have a custom that says that the extension is a number on any reproducing program, so it's name of the program dot number. It'll produce a new copy of the program with the same first name, but with a unique number as the last name. and it'll then run it. That's what the reproduce program does. So any program you want, if you want it to reproduce, you say reproduce $0 shell script. That's my name, the name I was called by, and it'll go make another one and run it. Ta-da! Okay, I toss that into a computer that doesn't have the reproduce program. Guess what? Never reproduces, right? It's not a virus in that system. Remember, viruses are relative to an environment. Okay? If you change the environment, it's not a virus. If you change the virus, it may not work in that environment. I can write environments where everything's a virus. I can write environments where nothing's a virus. This is creating a special environment for the viral reproduction. And that allows me to control the virus. And also, of course, it means I don't have to write all the program of having each one have a unique way of reproducing. If I standardize reproduction, then there's a lot less resource utilized by the reproductive process. It's standard, it's efficient, it's controllable, it's auditable. Okay, another one is, so this allows you to only reproduce also in authorized areas. The reproduce program, well, first of all, it'll only run in a place that has the reproduce program. Second of all, the reproduce program controls where it puts the programs. So maybe it only puts it in the directory where it was originally called from. No problem. Carrying Trojan horses, it's no different from any other program. Okay? Yeah, a virus can have a Trojan horse, so can any program. In fact, when I install the reproduce program, it can have a Trojan horse too. So that's right, I've allowed the potential for Trojan horses by allowing programs to run in my environment. If I don't want Trojan horses, I need to stop running programs in my environment. I haven't checked out in front. All right, those are the negatives and how to counter them. Here are the positives. The internet virus, let's see, how much, do you anybody know how much performance that thing had? The average performance was 32 MIPS, million instructions per second on 6,000 computers, plus about 3.2 MIPS on another 60,000 computers, or a grand total of about 384 billion instructions per second. A third of a teraflop. That's what the internet worm, internet virus, got in terms of computing performance. In 1988. Whoa. Ouch. That's screaming performance. In today's environment, you could probably get a few hundred teraflops. You could be, by two orders of magnitude, the fastest computing process ever to exist by writing a virus today that does effectively what that did. It held the parallel processing record for 3 years. Okay, that is, it was 3 years until another program achieved that many instructions per second. And it was written by one student in a few weeks. Okay, so one author in a few weeks can write something that outperforms everything else in the world in terms of its ability to use computing cycles. It ran on existing general-purpose computers. So no custom hardware, nothing like that required. It was overtaken after 3 years by a custom-designed parallel processor after hundreds of people years and millions of dollars of cost. Okay? It cost literally hundreds of millions of dollars to produce a system that outperformed what a college student did in a couple of weeks. So, it achieved efficient, uniform distribution, very reliable operation. Okay, even though computers that were part of this thing were taken down intentionally, and hundreds of people all over the world were intentionally trying to stop it, it still continued to operate. Think of it in terms of military. If I have some important military computation, the enemy's blowing things up, it'll still do its computation. You have a nuclear war, it'll still do it. Near optimal resource utilization. It was using almost 100% of the available resources all the time. Nothing was wasted. There's only one problem, and that is it was used for evil rather than for good. In fact, if that virus would have spread out and solved some really important problem, like perhaps found a cure for some strange disease that we could find a cure for by running that kind of a program, or did some analysis and determined that some major environmental impact could be avoided by some minor change in the way we did things, he would have received a Nobel Prize instead of instead of a guilty verdict. Okay? The fundamental problem is finding good uses. The technology has every advantage for computing that we've been seeking in our other programs. High performance, good uniform distribution, reliable, efficient resource utilization, reliable operation under accidental and malicious attempts at disruption. These are, if I wrote a list of these specifications for a regular program, for a big distributed computing system, people would be screaming, yes, yes, we want it. We just don't use the word, the B word. Don't use the B word. Just call them live programs. Or call them, oh, it's an intelligent agent. They'll buy that. We're going to demonstrate emergent behavior by using a multitude of semi-intelligent agent-based applications, blah, 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 blah. We're going to write viruses.
You just say it did some good by raising the awareness of the need for safety.
Yeah, well, yes, but the, yeah, sure, it did some good by raising the need for awareness, but I don't think so. I think it was more harmful. I don't want you to think that this is an isolated incident. Look at the history of viruses. We had theoretical work on viruses and replication in the 1950s by John von Neumann. In the ARPANET, there were centrally controlled distributed processing experiments that were virus-like, that were for good purposes. The game of life that runs as a screensaver, not the board game, but the screensaver that has these little blocks that can reproduce depending on what their neighbors look like. You can build things in that environment that are stable or astable reproductive systems. Those are viruses relative to that computing environment. Right? It's a program, a set of states in a finite state machine that reproduces. It copies itself to somewhere else. You get these little arrows that move across the screen in life. That's a virus. That meets the definition of a computer virus for games. The Xerox Worm program was a centrally controlled distributed processing in the 1970s and 80s. And it resulted ultimately in service denial because of an error in the way it was written and the lack of adequate caution. But otherwise, it was very successful at doing parallel processing using an existing infrastructure for a period of years. The first virus experiments in the 1980s were theory and experiments to demonstrate the principles. And then the first real-world viruses happened after 1985. So this is where we started to see the bad side. The game of Core Wars in the 1980s was nothing wrong with that, interesting. Artificial life as a field started in the late 1980s. A lot of use of parallel processing for reasonable purposes. All benevolent uses of reproductive systems, viruses. Most of the history is actually good. Give you an example of a system. This is the viral bill collector. It was implemented in both Unix and DOS. Worked in limited function environment. Had simple individual collectors, just little programs that knew how to collect the bill. Their reproduction was a function of their success. If money came in on that bill, then that was considered a success and it was reproduced into the gene pool. Okay, so you'd get random birth from the gene pool. Over time, the virus would wake up as more information came along in the collection process. If it didn't collect the bill, it wasn't allowed to reproduce. If it did collect the bill, it was reproduced into the gene pool, yielding a higher probability that it would be used in the future. And over time, the population of the gene pool evolved towards the bill collection routines that tended to be better at what they did. Now, over time, what works and doesn't work in bill collection changes over different sorts of cases and so forth. So this gene pool changes over time and over situation, the sorts of bills you're collecting and so forth. It adapts to the collection environment that you work in to try to optimize performance, or at least to make performance better. So that was decommissioned after operating for 13 years, about a year and a half or 2 years ago. The network that ran in also had maintenance viruses. These were viruses that did normal maintenance tasks. Okay, so for example, there are basic systemic flaws like undeleted temporary files, unterminated processes that shouldn't be hanging around, old versions of files, core files, a.alt under Unix, improper protection settings and so forth. It just sort of happened because systems are not perfect. So what we did was built the basic maintenance functions into maintenance viruses. We had a bunch of different maintenance viruses that did different things. One would get rid of core and 8.0 files, another one would get old versions and so forth. And you would create a population, periodically insert one of each so that nothing could become extinct. And these would, you know, just be sort of chosen at random to wake up. And what they would do is they would run for a period of time. And if they found food, food in the form of a core file to delete, if you find a core file, you can reproduce. So now there are two things here looking for core file. So what happens is, and given the total amount of available resources for these to use per day, the ratio of different maintenance viruses matches the maintenance functions to be performed. And as the system is used differently, the ratio changes. So if we should start using the system heavily in a way that creates a bunch of core files, we'll grow more core deletion viruses. And they'll go out and kill off the core files more often, and the system will spend more of its unused resources in cleaning up core files than it spends in looking for unterminated processes. But if we should start to find more unterminated processes, the ecosystem will evolve to match the need. So the population of viruses adapts through reproduction. Ultimately, the goal is to move towards selective survival. Essentially, you evolve things through human reprogramming or through random variations. And then the reproduction is a function of success, which is to say, reproduction means survival. Right? If you don't reproduce, you die. So you need a death process here somewhere. You get local optimizations. So if you happen to have programs that are near something where hill climbing will work, you'll tend to get more of those. Minor variations around that will tend to succeed. You'll have other portions of the space where you don't have much success. You can then shake the space, essentially, by crossbreeding. Okay, you take different things that have worked in these different breeds and you say, all right, this one did things every 2 hours instead of every 3 hours over here, but this one looked for 8.0 instead of core files. So you crossbreed them. And now you have something that takes 3 hours and looks for core files instead of 2 hours looking for core files, or 3 hours looking for 8.0 files. And maybe it creates a new place in the space where you get even more optimization. Maybe that survives better. Maybe not. Maybe it dies out. Okay? Questions, comments, issues?